Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at those times. But the podcasts are also available. I was going to say they're available everywhere. Not quite. But they are available on the radio show's page as well as the homepage of richarddugan.com, SoundCloud, and iTunes. And sometime down the road here, we're going to expand a little bit more to that. If you'd like to help support this radio broadcast, we are always gratefully appreciative of any support that you can offer. We have a couple of links up on the website. One is to PayPal, so that if you'd like to support the program in that fashion, we are always grateful. Any amount is gratefully appreciated and received. And we also have a new hookup, if you will, a new connection to a website called, I believe it's pronounced Patreon. But there's a link there, and you can go there and check that out as well. And also, if you have any ideas for guests for this program or ideas for this program, we would love to hear from you. I mean, I'm a pretty creative kind of guy, but, you know, can always use a little extra help. It can't hurt. And plus the fact it'll be something that you would like to hear about. Well, today we're going to continue our series, so to speak. It's ongoing ever since we started doing this program. Quite honestly, ever since I started interviewing back in almost 40 years ago, how about that? And it's tied into one of the other areas that I often say is near and dear to my heart, that of transitioning or death and dying. But we're going to be talking about that, but also talking about loss, the loss of just about anything that is meaningful and important to you. We're going to be talking about how to find enduring wholeness after loss and grief. Sweet Sorrow is the title of the book. And Sherry, and is it pronounced Cormier?
Cormier. There's about 100 different ways, Richard, and I answered about all of them.
Well, Sherry, I'm glad that you've joined us here on the program. And thank you so much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Well, this is a tough one for some folks because, it's your personal story then. I am still kind of going through the grieving process, the loss of a dear friend of mine who lived in Missouri for his final years. And I didn't even know that the man was 70. I trained him in broadcasting. We worked together for many, many years back in Phoenix. He actually came in, and he was one of those guys back in the, are you ready for the 80s, who used to shave his head. And he always told me that I should do the same. And so it wasn't until 2001 that I eventually did, but for other reasons. And it was not hair loss. It was literally I shaved it. And so ever since then, he always would, whenever we'd get on the phone or we'd meet in person, hey, Balbretta, you know, and we were just really good friends, talked about a lot of stuff. And even some of the things that I'm going through now, I wish I could pick up the phone and chat with him and just kind of see what was happening. But he passed away back in September, on the 12th of September of 2018. And still missing him. I'm in touch with and contact with his wife from time to time and his son. So there's that. And then, of course, I'm not grieving the loss yet, but of my dog, who's almost 17 years of age, can't walk, wears a diaper, lays on pee pads. I have to help her in and out of the house, all of that kind of stuff. And I know that the day is going to come when we're going to have to say, okay, quality of life, not there. It's time to let her go. Then you've got the prospect, not mine, thank you, because I haven't heard anything. I hope you haven't, Sherry. Loss of a job, or maybe loss of a relationship, and not just such as mine, but maybe something closer, like a spouse, or a parent, or a brother, or sister. Or wouldn't it also be, as I said earlier, also just the loss of anything that is meaningful to us?
Yes.
And I know that there are those who are around people who are grieving, who have suffered loss, and it goes on and on and on and on. And finally, they get frustrated. Well, God, it's been 15 years. Why won't you get over it? You know, kind of thing.
Right.
And, of course, the comment from the experts is everybody grieves in their own space and time.
Yes. And Richard, you said such an important thing, and I want to respond to it. I also want to acknowledge you're in Santa Barbara.
Yes.
And
there's a lot of grieving going on there.
There's a lot of grieving. I was in California about 6 weeks ago, and on a vacation, for a wonderful vacation for about 10 days. And there's a lot of grieving in California because of the wildfires and the mudslides and everything that people are losing. And, you know, one of the things that occurs to me is when you talk about, you know, you lose your home or your belongings to a wildfire, or you lose your job, or you just lost your friend, you're anticipating losing your dog. My dog died. So, man, that's so hard.
Yeah.
But one of the things I think about is, you know, there are voluntary losses and involuntary losses. And they both involve grief and bereavement. Most of the things that you mentioned are involuntary. You know, when your friend dies, you have to put your pet dies, or you have to put your pet to sleep. You lose your home to a wildfire. Those are involuntary. In my case, I lost my husband and my father, my mother, my sister, my dog. I've had all involuntary losses. Often a job loss is involuntary. You know, you're told, guess what? Our company is going under. You're going to lose your job in a month.
Yeah.
Sometimes people choose to leave a situation, though. Like, I've had many friends, and you probably have too, that have decided to leave a job or to leave a house and move, or to leave a state and move somewhere else, or to leave a relationship. Those are voluntary losses because we are choosing them. And in a way, they're a little bit easier to digest because we have the illusion, and I do want to stress that, because it's an illusion. We have the illusion where we have some control because we're choosing the loss. Yet, even with voluntary losses, even saying I'm going to choose to move away, or I'm going to choose to move to a different house, or I'm going to choose to leave this relationship, or I'm going to choose to leave this job, there's still a period of grief and bereavement and healing. And this thing that you mentioned, I really want to respond to it. I think it's so important, Richard. If I leave listeners with one idea today, this might be, I think, the most important one. We are so grief phobic, I think, in the United States. You know, we live in cultural conditions in the United States, by and large, in which we favor beginnings, we favor startups, we avoid endings, we don't like terminations of any kind. And so I think we don't want to talk about grief, and we get very uncomfortable when people around us are suffering from loss and grief. We feel very awkward about how to respond to people. In fact, I have one entire chapter in my book, Sweet Sorrow, about how do we comfort people who are grieving? What do we say? What can we do? But I think because of our own discomfort, we do give the message to people, just get over it. Nobody that I know, and I've counseled a lot of people with significant losses, no one that I know gets over grief. And that's really not the goal of healing from grief. The goal is not to get rid of grief. It's to integrate grief into our lives and be able to grow from the process, but not to get rid of it or move on. And I think that concept is offensive, really, to people who are bereaved, yeah, because they just know that this isn't something that you get over. But we say that because we're just so uncomfortable ourselves.
Yeah. And there is a phrase that is often used, and you tell people not to use it. But at the same time, I would then pose the question, but if I have suffered similar kind of grief, to mm-hmm. say to that person, I know how you feel.
Right.
Isn't that true, or is it still not one of the best phrases to be using?
It's not one of the best phrases, only because you mentioned this earlier. everyone experiences grief a little bit differently. And everyone's journey with grief is different. And, you know, I think of grief as a spectrum. And honestly, I've had some people I've worked with that, let's say, I'm thinking of a woman in particular. She had cared for her husband, two women. One had cared for her husband who had had cancer for 15, 18 years. Another one had cared for her husband with dementia for many years. So when their husbands or their partners died, they were grief-stricken, and at the same time, they were relieved because they had sort of had to put their life on the shelf for many years in order to care for that partner. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, I've known people who cannot make any headway in their recovery from loss. And they suffer from what we call complicated grief. About 1 out of 10 people, maybe 7 to 10% of people who go through a significant loss. And it's usually a person like a spouse or a child. Often it's losing someone to a senseless, violent death, like in these horrific mass shootings we're seeing far too much of in this country. But they suffer from complicated grief where they really cannot learn to integrate it. And so that's a very intense kind of grief at the other end of the spectrum. Those people really require professional help in order to be able to work with the grief and integrate it into their lives and be able to grow in a way that they just don't remain stuck. So that's kind of what we want to do with grief and loss, is not to become stuck in it. But we don't exactly know how anyone does feel. So I think saying to someone, you know, I like the word acknowledgement. Acknowledging, I know, Richard, I know your friend just died in September, and I'm sorry to hear this news. He sounds like he was such a wonderful friend. I like saying something about the person who's died or about the loss. Like, I'm sorry about hearing about the house that you lost in the wildfire. If it's a person and you know them, you can talk about them. People like that. And then just asking in sort of an open-ended way, how could I be most helpful at this time? Because we don't really know. Some people want you around. Some people say, oh, I want to talk with you. May I reach out to you in a week? Some people say, oh, come over now. I really need someone around me right now. It's just so idiosyncratic.
You know, another part of this that you actually, you touch upon as well, and I have to say that... I would say that I personally am suffering from this. Never thought I would. I am not a military person. Don't have a lot of close relatives who are. But I moved from Phoenix. Now, there's a voluntary grief process, although I don't recall really grieving that much. Okay. When we moved in 2006 from Phoenix, where I was born and raised, after 46 years, we said, I'm out of here. Can't take the heat. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. And moved to Santa Barbara, been here since, so now you're talking 12 years.
Yes.
Been through 12 fires. I was only evacuated from one in 2017, so very fortunate there. But I got to tell you, there were some pictures of the probably rather infamous, if you will, and more famous fire, the Thomas Fire from 2017, December. December 10th, and I will never, it's one of those days, you know, that you never forget. We were watching television. We were outside any of the evacuation zones, and we're watching the TV, and we're watching the smoke rise from the front side of the hillside. And I'm not kidding you, and people joke about this, or they think I'm kidding. When I'm looking at these pictures, and I'm thinking, I better get my resume up on the computer and start to update it, because it looks like this fire is coming down into Santa Barbara, and it's going to burn the town to the ground. and I'm not going to have a place to work. So I better start, you know, getting that together. And of course, thank God that didn't happen. But it's PTSD. And some people do not believe that people who go through these kinds of things, it's like, oh, no, 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 that only happens in the military. You know, Vietnam and Iraq. And
the military is one thing, but PTSD can happen to anybody who suffers a trauma. It could be sexual assault, which is in the news these days. It could be the military. It could be just the whole experience of being through 12 fires and knowing the devastation and the anticipation. You know, it sounds like you almost have what I would call anticipatory grief. Like, when is the fire going to come that's going to destroy my livelihood?
Yeah.
Destroy my house. Yeah. And there's a lot of anxiety around that.
Now this,
that's very real.
Yeah, this may sound a little odd on the one hand, but there were times during some of these fires, and even when we were evacuated in July of 2017, when we're sitting in the hotel room, and I'm sitting here thinking, let it just wipe out the house. Let it wipe out the. Now, we were renters, so, you know, we're not going to lose that from that standpoint, but all of our possessions. And I'm thinking, oh, just let it come. Just let it burn everything to the ground so we can just start over. So we don't have to haul that stuff to our next place of, of residence. And yet I then I started running through my mind, and this is after the fact. I'm thinking, okay, wait a minute. Now, what things are up there that I really would like to hang on to? Little mementos, you know, maybe from my friend Dennis or maybe from other situations and so forth.
Pictures, photos.
Yeah.
I mean, even though we're digitalized now, I still have, and I'm sure you do too, many old family photos.
I got a wooden box that I built, and this is a good size box filled with photographs that I took of Phoenix in the 70s and 80s of what our Main Street used to look like, you know, and so forth. So a little historic value, but also photography class in college and those kinds of things. So yeah, absolutely. And of course, so what we've done is we have taken them out of the house and we have placed them in what we'd like to think it's still in Santa Barbara, a safe place. Exactly. You know, you move them there. I mean, I felt so badly for so many of the people in Ventura who continued to move and be evacuated to the west. And the fire kept coming to the west, you know, which was contrary to the way a lot of these fires are supposed to move. And it was like, what the heck is going on here? But anyway, you're working with people to move from post-traumatic stress to post-traumatic growth. Describe that.
That's about what I was just going to say. You know, the thing is, we don't have to stay stuck in post-traumatic stress. And we know this from two fellows, two psychologists, Richard Tedeschi, T-E-D-E-S-C-H-I, and Lawrence Calhoun, who were on the faculty at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. And they had an interesting thing about 20 years ago. They said to themselves one day, they woke up and had their chai latte, and they said, you know, we're kind of tired of studying people who are stressed. We want to study people who are wise. We want to see what wise people do and what kind of wisdom they have. And so it's interesting that you mentioned veterans, because they've studied a lot of veterans who've come back from different kinds of deployment. They also initially studied people with severe injuries, who were left paralyzed with some part of their body, you know, paralyzed. And then they also looked at older people who had lost their spouses and partners. And in all these populations, they found some really consistent things, Richard. And I personally and professionally find this fascinating. What they found is, without a doubt, everyone would say, and even these vets, some of whom had witnessed horrific things, you know, in Iraq or Afghanistan or the Gulf War or back even to Vietnam, they would all say, I didn't choose to see what I saw. I didn't choose to go through this loss, but this has made me a better person. So every group that they talked with and interviewed and researched all said this. This has made me a better person, even though I would not have chosen to have this experience in my life. I recognize that I have grown from it. And what we know about post-traumatic growth is that we're not talking about, you know, sort of little daily stressors. You know, we're not talking about sitting in the line of traffic on Highway 1 in California when you're going to Big Sur, for example. We're not talking about the fact that I wanted to go kayaking today and it might be raining and so I couldn't do that. We're talking about more events that are more seismic, if you think about a volcanic eruption, and really shatter our core. You know, they really cause us to re-examine who we are. They shatter our assumptions about life, about the world that we think we have known and the way we have known it. They shatter our assumptions about people. So these are the kinds of events that seem to result in post-traumatic growth. So it's not every little upsetting event. And you know, the catalyst for post-traumatic growth, there seems to be one thing that is the catalyst for post-traumatic growth in these situations. And that is the attempt to find meaning. And this is really actually the new thrust in the growth literature from grief. You know, we've been studying grief for a long time. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross many years ago talked about the stages of grief, and we don't really use those much anymore. We talk more about phases of grief. I believe grief is more of a cyclical process than a linear process. But the new thrust really in healing from grief is, how do we find meaning? You know, what is the meaning in for you in losing your friend? What's the meaning for us when we lose a pet or we lose a job or we do have to lose our house or belongings to a wildfire or a flood? You know, we have a lot of people on the southeastern coast in North and South Carolina that have lost homes now to flooding from Hurricane Florence. So what is the meaning in this? And that's hard to find initially, because initially, you know, we didn't choose this to happen. We didn't want this to happen. But over time, we start to see things about ourselves and about the world. And my own personal losses started a decade ago. A decade ago, my father died, and 3 months later, my beloved husband died. He had just gotten diagnosed with stage 4 inoperable cancer. So within 3 months, I lost the two most important men in my life. And then several years after that, my mother died. Then the rescue dog that I rescued after my dad and my husband died to just provide some sense of companionship, my golden girl, Abby, she died. And then about 18 months ago, my only sibling and sister died. So I waited to write this book because so many of these books are written in the immediate aftermath of loss. I wanted to provide a more longitudinal perspective on how do we heal and recover from loss and grief over time. And that's what post-traumatic growth really tells us, is that over time, we don't see the loss event in the same way that we used to. Like immediately, you know, we're angry and we're betrayed and we're upset and we're enraged. Over time, we have some real shifts. And we see shifts in really about 5 areas. And these 5 areas are things that we all see in grief survivors who are able to grow from loss rather than it continue to be stressed by it. And the first thing that we see, Richard, and I'm sure you can resonate with this, with all these wildfires, is we get this renewed appreciation for life itself, and we realize how fragile life is, and also how precious life is. We realize life is a gift, and sometimes the closer we come to death, or the more we've lived around death, the more we realize that life is so, so precious, and we really want to make the most of it.
Yeah.
A couple other things. We realize that we're different. I'm not the same person I was 10 years ago. I'm like a steel magnolia now. We realize we get much stronger. Loss and grief, bereavement, that all makes us stronger. We realize that we have much more personal strength than we did. So we realize that. We also realize that we see new possibilities for ourselves that we weren't aware of before all of the losses. So we have that going on. We also feel a greater sense of some kind of spirituality in our life, some kind of connection to the divine, if you will. Maybe the presence of our spirit guides or better angels in our life. And we also, finally, I would say, I think we recognize our need for people and relationships, and we become much more attentive to our family and our friends and nourishing those relationships because we know how important that is for healing and for growth after loss.
Yeah. Well, one of the first things that comes to my mind, and I'm going to say this, it's sort of a flippant phrase that came to my mind when you were talking about that, and that was, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
But there's truth to that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And, you know, and then, of course, there's the other aspect of it, too. I went through a rather tumultuous divorce back in Phoenix in 1998. Mm-hmm. And it was about 2010, 11, 12. I can't remember what year it was now. I just happened to call my ex-wife to just see how she was doing, let her know that, hey, I never stopped caring. Mm-hmm. And she shared with me, of course, a lot of stuff that was going on with her. And then she said that, oh, yeah, by the way, my father passed away of an aneurysm, and 4 months later, my mother passed away of a broken heart, and then a month later, my best friend died on the operating table, and it was those first two, and I have to tell you, I was less grief-stricken and more angry, because we'd been married for 15 years, spent 15 Christmases and New Year's and Easter's and Thanksgivings and so forth together, and nobody made the effort to call me and let me know. That's what really bothered me more than anything. And yes, it's very sad. And of course, she's lost both her parents in a very short period of time. My parents are still alive and kicking. Mm-hmm. But the other aspect of this whole thing with the fires, you know, you talk about, you know, as you say, once you've gone through it, it's the appreciation for life. Mm-hmm. When I first started experiencing them in 2006, there was an enormous amount of fear when I saw one break out way off into the distance, right? And because I didn't know who to call, I didn't know what direction to go, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, you didn't know what to do, and you didn't feel safe, I'm sure.
Now, it is now 12 years later. I don't get fearful anymore. I get angry. I get so angry that this had to start again. And 9 times out of 10, they say this statistically, 9 out of 10 wildfires are started by humans. Mm-hmm. And who did something stupid that started this whole thing? But there was one other thing that you said earlier that, hang on. The one thing that I find interesting too is that, you know, you said that some people, you know, you go through some of these things and you don't choose to go in a particular direction, or you didn't choose this particular situation. And at one level, that's true. But at the same time, and I could sit here going, you know, we could sit here saying, well, Richard, you didn't choose to go through what you went through with your ex-wife. And then, of course, the loss of her parents and so forth. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that I did by virtue of marrying this woman, about having that relationship for 15 years. Right. So on a sort of maybe, I don't know, a subconscious or unconscious level, I chose to move here.
Ergo, I was going to say, and you chose to move to California to get out of the Phoenix heat.
Yeah, I went from one.
And I, of course, chose to marry my husband who died. Yeah. And then some people would say that as souls, we chose the family that we're born into, depending on your spirituality philosophy. So, there, you know, that's all that is true. And of course, you could choose to move away from California, although you may not want to. And I'm not, you know, I think anywhere, you know, like now we have floods on the East Coast, which is where I live. So,
isn't that exciting?
Take your poison, right? Or your medicine or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing is that regardless of sort of our life circumstances or where we are, whether we're here, whether we were veterans, and gosh, their service to our country has been so critical and so important. If there are any vets listening today, I just applaud all the veterans.
And I do not want to minimize what they went through in any way, shape, or form.
And I don't think I could face what they faced.
Oh, you know,
You know, we just went through. Speaking of Phoenix, we just went through John McCain's loss.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But I think that what they were trying to say, this whole thing about, they were trying to say, you know, the loss it wasn't something that I would have wanted to have happened. It wasn't like I would have wanted to have had my husband die or wanted to have witnessed what I saw in war or wanted to have lost my house to a wildfire in that sense.
Right.
But I, you know, and post-traumatic growth is not the same as happiness. So we can grow from loss. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're happier, we probably are stronger, and we probably are more resilient.
Yeah.
Resilience comes from this Latin word that actually means to rebound.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, hopefully it means that our ability to rebound from challenging situations in life grows stronger. Because I'm convinced no matter where you live or what choices you've made in life, sooner or later, we are all going to face a very challenging situation, whether it's loss or something else.
Yeah.
That does, you know, hit us, smack us in the face.
Exactly. You know, to live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and when the time comes, to let it go.
To be able to let it go.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest thing.
Yeah. Sweet Sorrow is the title of the book. My guest, Cherry Cormier, and we are talking about grief and loss and all of those all those fun things. We're going to talk more about this as we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Please stay tuned.
Tell me your story.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We are giving you choices on which way to turn next when there is that process going on in your life called grief. And it comes, it does indeed. You know, Cherry, there's something about this that I wanted to address with you that I find rather interesting. I was thinking about this, of course, in light of what we sort of defined the losses, as it were. And it can be pretty much anything. But one of the things that came to mind, and this is somebody that I know who is fast approaching 70 and obviously is already in the retirement years, but is still working.
Mm-hmm.
Has a dream that they've had for some, according to them, 40 years, and it's all they've ever wanted. I mean, it sounds so simple, all right? And I'm going to keep it simplistically simple.
Okay.
They just wanted a piece of white paper. That's all they wanted, just a piece of paper. But for those entire 40 years, couldn't make it happen. For whatever reason, down the road, they couldn't make it happen. And now, here they are in their late 60s, and they think that it's over, that that dream was never going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so now you're talking about the perceived, because you used the word earlier, and it is the perceived loss of a dream.
Right. Well, and you know, the thing is, that's a huge loss for many people. For example, I've worked with some individuals and couples, women and couples, who dream, young couples, young women, who've always dreamed of having a child, and then for one reason or another found out they could not bear children. That's a huge loss of a dream, just like this friend that you've mentioned. So, you know, it's all sometimes not even losing something that we have to let go of. It's letting go of a vision for our life, a dream that we have. And certainly if we lose a partner, for example, we're letting go of a loss, sort of a dream of the future. Because, you know, don't we all, if you're partnered or even with your children, if you have children, if you're blessed to have children as I am, don't we all have dreams for the future with our children? They do this, they do that. They do this when they grow up. They get this when they grow up. Or with our partner, we're going to do this. Or this friend of yours, gee, I'm going to get this. I'm going to obtain this. Losing it, you know, sometimes grieving something we wanted but never had is just as powerful as losing something that we had but doesn't remain in our life. And you know, I think this whole thing that you mentioned, Richard, of letting go, that is so important, because the thing is, we develop attachments. And you mentioned anger, and I love the writer Anne Lamott, and she said something about expectations are resentments under construction.
Oh, wow.
Expectations are resentments under construction. Anne Lamott, source of that quote. And, you know, we develop all these expectations for ourselves, for life, for our future, for people in our life we're connected to. And when our expectations don't get met or don't get realized, we get pissed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and we feel betrayed, and we feel duped, and we feel sad. And, you know, so in some ways, it's not getting so attached to our expectations and even our plans. You know, we develop this set of plans. We think, oh, I'll grow up and this is the way my life will be. Or we'll get married and this is the way our life will be. I mean, I never thought my life would be, I never thought I'd be on the radio with you this morning or Skyping with you 10 years ago, because I was still married to the love of my life. And, you know, we probably would be doing something completely different now. So life always throws us curveballs.
Yeah.
But if we hold on to our expectations too tightly, if we maintain a very tight grip on our expectations and our plans, we're going to have a very hard time letting go. And I love to read Eckhart Tolle and, you know, his books like The Power of Now. I think Eckhart Tolle is such a wise soul. And he says, you know, the tighter we hold on, the less we let go. And the less we let go, the more we suffer. We resist. We want to resist. But we know from like Pema Chodron, who's another great author, that life is impermanence. You know, everything about life is constantly changing. our own cells in our body turn over within a year or two. Some cells take longer to turn over, but by year 7 or 8, we have completely new cells in our body.
Mm-hmm.
So everything is always energetically changing in the world. Nothing is ever in a state of permanence, but we get these expectations and these ideas and these plans that we act as if everything should always stay the same. And then we suffer because when we get a change and we're confronted with a situation where we are faced with, hey, impermanence, nothing is forever, no one is forever, then we get very frustrated and very upset and very reactive. And the only thing that that does is that sort of stirs up the emotional part of our brain. And then we need to make friends with ourselves, make friends with our emotions, make friends with mindfulness and meditation practices, which we know over time calms that emotional brain so that we are better able to cope with all of these daily challenges and all of these times when really our mind is not always our best friend.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand that and relate to that. No question about it, because there are times when, yeah, I've kind of come to the conclusion that even as last night, as I'm laying there in bed and my mind just will not shut off from all of the challenges that are ahead that I am facing. And what I have discovered over the years, and again, I realize this is perception, is that the last place you want to be dealing with those mental challenges, those musings, is at night. Because at night, it's dark, there are no boundaries, and so they seem huge.
Yes.
That you want to do it.
Overpowering.
Yeah. You want to do it in the light of day. When the light can be shined on it, and it then begins to take on the perception of something much smaller, less abhorrent and obtrusive and so forth.
Yes. I have a little thing I actually do when I had a night like that last night too.
Oh my goodness.
Because I have a big list now of things I need to do, and there's not enough time in the day, and sounds like you're one of those people too.
Mm.
But if I find that I'm keeping myself awake because I keep thinking these intrusive thoughts about, I forgot to do this, or I got to do this, or tomorrow, blah, 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 I actually get up, write it down, say to myself, release it, breathe and exhale the release, exhale it out, go back to bed.
Mm.
I find there's something in writing it down that seems to relieve me of needing to hang on to it at night.
Yeah, since you've now got it on something material, something somewhat permanent.
Yeah, and then like you say, in the morning when it's the light of day, I can pick up my notes and say, "Oh yes, I remember that from last night." Now
there is one. I was going to say there is one other option. You could always call Mike Tyson. He'd come over and cold cock you, knock you out. You also talk about something that has been near and dear to my heart for decades before I ever moved to Santa Barbara. And I had no plans on moving to Santa Barbara specifically.
Mm-hmm.
All I know is that for decades I wanted to move to the ocean. Now, when I met my second wife, we traveled twice to Ireland, which, by the way, is where I want to end up.
Interesting.
If someone walked in here right now and said, I have 2 tickets and everything, all expenses paid for you to move and live in Ireland, I would be saying, thank you so much, Sherry, and good night. I would be out the door. But one of the things that you talk about also, which really resonated with me, was about why people often want to be near the water when they're healing, which leads me to wonder if for decades, because I've wanted to do this for so long, I've been in the healing process because I've wanted to get to the water. Tell me about that connection to water that you've made there.
I will, and I'm smiling and laughing and really resonating with your story, Richard, because see, I lived in the mountains until about 7 years ago, and then I picked up and made a geographical move, and I live on a peninsula surrounded by water now.
Oh, beautiful.
So I did the same thing, and of course I've been to Santa Barbara, and it's, you know, the ocean there is spectacular. Well, the thing about water is there's a fellow by the name of Dr. Wallace Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S, who's written a great book about this called Blue, the color blue, Mind, M-I-N-D. What we know about being near water, and it isn't that everyone has to do what you did or I did and pick up and move to the water, but I think if you're recovering from stress or post-traumatic stress or loss or any kind of difficult, challenging life event, even a visit or a vacation to the water can be very restorative. What we know is that when we spend time near the water, whether we live near the water or we vacation near the water, is it changes our brain. It really reduces the levels of our stress hormones. There's a stress hormone circulating in the body called cortisol. It reduces the levels of cortisol, and it increases the levels of our feel-good hormones in the body. And those would be things like dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin. So it's kind of a double gift because our feel-good hormones get stronger and our stress hormones get weaker when we spend time around the water. And so I think that's a big part of it. We feel calmer, we feel happier, we feel less stressed, we feel less anxious. And you know, the other thing that strikes me about why it's maybe in particular healing for grief to be near the water is sort of a metaphysical thing. And this actually came up in one of my radio shows last week with a mother and daughter team near Vancouver. Although they were near the wine country, and maybe this was because of the wine. I don't know. Wine is good, relaxing thing. But, you know, if you think about it, grief is an emotion that has a flow to it, and there's a flow to water. And we don't do ourselves any good when we try to stop the flow of the emotion of grief. We don't do ourselves any good when we try to repress it, or shove it under the ground or under the table or stifle it. The only way really to heal from grief is to allow that emotion and the energy of it to flow through us, to be able to process the grief. And so maybe there's something about being near the flow of water that really allows us to be able to do that. And you know, the other thing that came up for me in another radio show, and this is a fascinating thing, but if you think about it, our bodies are made up of mostly water. And so many of us, I think, are in a constant state of dehydration. Why, there's places near me where I live, and I bet near you too in California, where I could actually go to get an IV infusion, a saline infusion, to help hydrate my body. So I think there may be something about water that helps us with our energy after we go through a challenging event or a loss event, because it sort of replenishes and restores our body and helps us to feel like we're more connected to the water element in our bodies. I don't know. Do you think that, does that, any of that resonate? You live near the water. Does it resonate with you?
It does. It absolutely does. I unfortunately don't spend as much time there as I'd like. And it's very strange because I kid you not, I could walk from where I'm sitting right now. And in 20 minutes, I will be at the beach. All right. I can have my feet, my tootsies in the surf.
The Pacific Ocean. Yeah.
Yeah. And and yet, by the same token, I'm working on the technologies to be able to take this conversation that we're doing via Skype and conduct it on my phone and record it at the same time while sitting in my beach chair out at the surf. Now, I've done this. I have
Call
done this.
And you can do that. Absolutely. We'll have another conversation. And I'll go take my beach chair
there
and
my
beach, and we'll do it water to water.
Well, believe it or not, I have actually had a guest on the program who we went out to the beach to conduct the interview. And what I did, of course, was I had two microphones plugged into my digital recorder and so forth and so on. So it was really a lot of fun. I mean, I enjoyed it. We, you know, I could hear the surf in the background as I'm recording it, but it wasn't intrusive. And actually, it was for my year-ending program, 2017, year-ending 2017, but I also did it for our 10th anniversary. I just went out solo, sat on a rock facing the south coast, facing the ocean, and just sat there and talked. And I had people who were walking by, and they noticed that I had a microphone, and one guy, he did a thumbs up, and he waved and did a thumbs up, and I did a thumbs up thank you, because he knew that, I was recording.
Speak to you. Yeah. Yeah.
But I would be quiet when people would walk by because I didn't want to interrupt what they were conversing about, if they were conversing at all. But it was such a tranquil experience. And of course, I'm trying to do more of that. I would love to do more of that, just sitting out there and conducting these kinds of conversations. The water has always been important to me from that standpoint, maybe partly because I lived in Phoenix for 46 years. And
it's very hot, arid, dry climate.
Yeah. And instead of taking 20 minutes to get to the beach, it'd take me 20 days.
Yeah.
And I wasn't about to even start that one. But when we would go to California, San Diego on vacations when I was a kid, we went to SeaWorld, and I think we even drove up to Disneyland and so forth. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I even remember my very first experience with the ocean, and it was at Huntington Beach. I was in the eighth grade. I managed in the last semester to get onto the National Junior Honor Society rolls, to the consternation of the other students.
Yeah.
And so, and what was in it for me was, well, a trip to Disneyland. And so there I am standing in the surf, and all of a sudden this wave comes in, and I didn't know about the undertow, and my feet got pulled out from under me, and I started to go out to sea.
Ooh.
Well, the real irony was, I can't help but share the story, the two girls who hated me the most in eighth grade were the two girls who saved me from going out to sea.
Wow.
Now go figure that one out. And I thank
that's the yin and the yang.
Yeah, I thank Leslie, I should say. I thank Leslie and Chris for keeping me alive at that time when I think I was 12 at the time. So it was quite an experience to say the least. But I have always loved just sitting there. I mean, I'll go out to the cliffs. There's a place called Shoreline Park, and it's a cliff overlooking the ocean. And then there are these steps. They say it's the 1,000 steps, but I don't think there are 1,000 of them. And you walk down there, or however you access it, and then there are rocks all along the shoreline. And you can just sit there and just listen to the water come in and out. If you stay long enough, you can sit there and listen to the water come in and then take you out because the tide will have come in. But I love being out on the water. If I get a chance to get out on a boat. You know, even though I'm not a fisherman, I went out fishing once and I was less interested in fishing than I was just being out on the water.
And, you know, I think as I'm sitting here listening to you, part of what I'm thinking about, too, is as special as the water is. And of course, I love the water. I moved to the water. What I'm also thinking about for people who don't live at the water is how important it is for healing from loss, or even just for healing from any challenging life event, to be out in nature. I was in Phoenix about a year ago, and I loved being in the desert there. I loved hiking. I think Sedona, being in the energy of those red rocks, is very magical. I think wherever we are, if we can find a forest or a woods, the Japanese are onto this. They have this concept called forest bathing, which is like, you know, trees emit a certain kind of energy. And if you go up farther up in California, around Santa Cruz, and you get in those redwoods.
Yeah, my wife wants to take me there.
Well,
we haven't been there yet.
Go.
Yeah.
I was there in August. But trees emit this energy. And I think anything we can do to be in nature, to get out of the technology, turn our technical stuff off for a while, get in nature, get back to the elemental. You know, we were born in water, so there's that. Get to water, get to trees, get to hiking, get to woods, get to mountains, get to red rocks, get to plants.
Yeah.
All of this emits energetic compounds, which are restorative and really good for our heart and our soul.
Yeah, this whole aspect, I used to joke with people about this, how I'm looking for that place that I can go where nobody can find this place but me.
Yes,
and
like
a secret garden. Exactly. And unfortunately, what I found out was, and then we're talking, of course, about the physical world, you know, if I can find it, so will other people. But then in one of my interviews, and it's like, it's not like I didn't know this already, you know, but for some reason it just didn't click until this was shared in the in an interview that I did about 7 or 8 years ago. There is a place I can go where nobody else can get to, and I can be contemplative and I can be quiet and I can do all of those things. And that place is within. Nobody
yes.
else can go there.
Yes, you know, it's your own internal place. And really, our healing externally is connected to the level of healing on the inside. Mm. And right, we can go inside and sit with ourselves and be with ourselves, and no one can take that away from us.
Well, I tell you, it is a challenge for us to go through. But as I have said many times on this program, and I am working on finally getting it culled down into a book that I've been working on for 17 years.
Good for you.
And I'm not rewriting War and Peace, mind you. It doesn't matter where you are or what circumstances you're going through. You always have choices. The question is, do you know that you have choices? And that's where education comes in. And that's what we try to do with this program, is educate people in an informal way, you know, to understand that, yes, I understand you have your beliefs. You have the places where you reside philosophically, intellectually, and so forth. But that doesn't mean that that's the be-all and end-all. I mean, what's the point of going to school, formal education, whether it, I mean, you have a PhD, my God, you could have finished at 12, you know, and be, you know, at the 12th grade and said, that's all I want. And I don't want, and I,
people do, and that's fine.
Yeah. And that's fine. But the whole process, I look at it, it's an educational evolution.
Right.
We evolve. And so we need to do that. And so we're trying to share that with people, that we're trying to help you to evolve, and we're trying to help people to raise the consciousness. Because would I be mistaken in putting it in this context that, though, again, we acknowledge that everybody goes through the grieving process of loss differently and at different time lengths, but that a lot of times we get stuck that prevents us from living out our life's purpose, and that if we could not push it aside, not push the grief aside or disavow it or anything, but maybe transform that energy into something else, like what you've done with your career as a psychologist, as well as this book and many others.
Right. Because, right, I became a, you know, not 10 years ago. I mean, I've been a psychologist for many years. Within the last decade, I've focused much more on bereavement and became a certified bereavement trauma specialist as well. And that I do consider that to be my life's work. I mean, you've hit on something so important, Richard, because I think whether it's, you know, a loss that you're up against or just something that's hitting you in the face that you didn't want to have happen, something that you didn't plan to have happen but feels very challenging to you, maybe in your family, maybe difficulty at work or whatever. You know, the word that came to my mind when I was listening to you is the word awakening. And, you know, I think if I had to just sum all this up in a little sentence, what I would say is these things, really, these difficult life events, really can be catalysts for our own awakening. And it's that awakening that can really help us discover our calling and what our true purpose in life is. Just like, you know, you're living out your purpose by this great radio program, Tell Me Your Story, and really connecting with people who have a story to share with all of your listeners. So how did you do that? Well, you know, at some level, I'm convinced you had an awakening. So the great thing, I mean, if there's a silver lining in any of the challenges that we all face from life, and we all will sooner or later, loss is a universal experience sooner or later. Remember that it is a catalyst for growth and awakening.
Well, we're all trying to wake up, you know, and just because it's funny too, because you'd think that a person such as myself doing a program such as this, oh yeah, I'm fully awake, I'm good to go, and let's just make life happen and just make things come about and so forth. It's like, hey, gang, I'm struggling just like everybody else. I'm human, and I've got the same challenges as everybody else. I wish I didn't sometimes. I mean, I share my frustration.
Aren't we? We're all imperfect.
Yeah. I mean, I share constantly how I'm frustrated with the whole dualism of this world because it makes no sense. The ancient wisdom teachings teach us where we came from, the one. They teach us where we're going to, the one.
Non-dualism, yeah.
So what the heck are we doing here, you know? And I, you know, and I get different answers, and that's fine. But the thing that I find so fascinating about these conversations and especially talking about this is that certainly, I mean, I joke with people, yeah, these radio programs, this is my therapy, you know. This is where I get my therapists. They change. Every program, they change. I never get the same one twice. Well, sometimes I do, or three or four times, but sometimes I don't see them or hear from them in for years. But it's one of those things where you need people around you. You need community. Let's talk about the essential aspect of connection and community in regards to this whole process of grieving and getting to that next phase, whether it be post-traumatic growth or happiness. And the frustration there is with our Constitution. It says you have life and liberty, but you don't get happiness. You have to pursue it. You can pursue it, but you don't get it. So I'm wondering, do we ever get there? It's like, you know, the carrot out on the string.
The more we try to get happiness, the less happy we are.
Yeah.
So there's that. You know, you raise the most important thing, and I'm so glad you just mentioned this, Richard. But because when we are sad and grief-stricken and heartbroken, we do not heal from that in isolation. And grief itself, I think, is a pretty isolating or can be a pretty isolating experience. I'm sure you've seen this, you've witnessed this, we've all witnessed this, your listeners, all of us. In the immediate aftermath of a significant loss or wildfire or losing a beloved or whatever, or a child or anything traumatic, people come around and they're there for the short term, but then they leave and we become very lonely. And yet we are hardwired in our brains to have several close confidants. We are hardwired to have social networks and social support. So developing a sense of community, finding our tribe, that is such an important part in healing. And I'm convinced that we do not heal and cannot heal and move forward without close connections with other people. That's that important.
Well, I know how important it is to surround ourselves, you know, have that support system. I have to say that I've been very fortunate to have that, both with the radio program, even on the facetious level, but also...
That's a form of connection.
It is. It is indeed. And I've always been very grateful to both to you and all my guests for their support in not only what we're doing with this radio program, but also in taking me on as a patient. Because I'm not one of your best patients in the world. I don't like needles, so keep those away from me. And thus are the advantages of using Skype or a phone line.
Yes.
But this to me is fascinating stuff, and I think people need to check it out. Sweet Sorrow is the title of the book. It is Finding Enduring Wholeness After Loss and Grief. And one final point I want to ask you about, and that is because whether we're talking about wildfires, or I know that my father, he turned 87 this year. My mother turned 84. And I know that one day, maybe not so soon, because we've got longevity on our on both sides of the family.
Good genes.
But one day I'm going to get that call. Mm-hmm. And my wife even said to me back prior to Easter? I think it was Easter. Maybe it was around their anniversary time. You need to fly back to Phoenix to spend some time with your parents because, you know. And I said, I don't need to do that. I'm fine. You know, no, you need to go. And so I acquiesced and popped the $500 into the ticket purchaser. And off I went. And I spent two days with them and then came home. And it was good. And I enjoyed it. And we had a wonderful time together. And I got to see some other friends while I was there as well. But I know, too, that that's going to happen again when one or both of them, and I don't know how it's going to happen or when or which one's going first. But I do suspect that when one goes, one is not going to be far behind because of the relationship that they have had.
And they're older.
Yeah, yes. For 60-plus years. I mean, they've been married for, what was it? They just celebrated in 2016 their 60th, so they just celebrated their 62nd back in June.
For life, which is more unusual these days.
Oh, yeah, really. Well, you know how bad I felt going through my divorce? I was so pissed because I was wanting to emulate their number.
You know? I know.
It was so frustrating. And it's like, oh, my God, now I've got to start over. And I'm thankful that I have been with my second wife now for 20 years, almost 21. But, you know, for me, milestones like that are so important. You know, it's like my first longest job was at a Christian radio station, and where I'm working now is number two, which is rather extraordinary. You just don't see people staying in one place for very long. But in terms of knowing that these things are coming,
yes,
I'm going to hazard a guess. It is not possible to prepare oneself for the inevitable process that one will go through.
I agree with that. I wish that it was possible. I mean, I certainly think we can do things that can help. I think that it's really important to have conversations with our loved ones, end of life conversations, so that we know what people's final wishes are.
Yeah.
What people want, and you know, as we get older, I think you talk about your parents in their 80s, as they think about their life coming to an end, you know, it's natural for them to want to think about their legacy and their values and what they want to pass on, what they have passed on to you. I think having those conversations, that's a really important thing. But I will just tell you, you know, when my husband was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer, when they did the diagnostic test that confirmed a tumor, the surgeon said to me privately, "Your husband has 6 to 12 months to live." He died 6 months later. So I had 6 months to prepare. And with my father, who died 3 months before that, he died from old age. He was 90 and he had had dementia for 8 years. I had 8 years to prepare for that. And none of that knowledge that I had, and even being a psychologist, none of that really kind of helped me. I wasn't prepared. I had many, many difficult, dark days, Richard, where it was just a struggle to get through the day. And thank God for my network of friends and other family members who really helped me cope. Because, you know, one of the things that we found is when we're in the presence of other people that we feel safe, whether it's our partner or spouse or kids or parents or friends, close friends, like the one regrettably you just lost, that our neurochemistry start to sync up. And again, it's kind of like being near the water. Our feel-good hormones get raised, get strengthened when we're around good people and safe people, and our stress hormones go down. So it's so important to try to help ourselves prepare for that when it does happen, to seek out people that feel safe to us.
Yeah.
But I think it's very hard to really prepare.
Yeah, there is no such thing as preventative maintenance when it comes to loss of any kind, for that matter, because you can't. I mean, you know, because
I think other than just knowing some of the things that we've shared today that. Yeah. You know, there's no permanence and things are impermanent, and not to grip our expectations too tightly and work on being flexible and being able to let go more easily. And I think I do think one tool that might be useful for preventative maintenance that really saved me was meditation. I've been a meditator for many years, and I've been a student of yoga for many years, which is where I first learned to meditate. And I think those kinds of practices really do sort of buffer. They kind of give us a buffer from trauma and stress, so that when we get hit with a loss, we are more likely to develop resilience and to rebound more easily than if we don't have those tools or those practices within us. I will say that.
This has been a fascinating program. I'm so grateful for your participation in it and sharing with us from the work that you're doing, as well as the book that you have out, Sweet Sorrow, Finding Enduring Wholeness and After Loss and Grief. And Sherry Cormier is my guest. And again, I thank you so much. The website, by the way, I believe, if I am not mistaken, Sherry, is just that, your name and the word author.com.
Yes. So, SherryCormierAuthor.com. And the book's available on all your online booksellers.
And I'm going to just spell that for people. SherryCormier Cormier, SherryCormier.com, SherryCormierAuthor.com is the website. Sweet Sorrow, Finding Enduring Wholeness After Loss and Grief. I know you've been out here to Santa Barbara before, but now I'm an extended invitation. Should you find yourself lost and out here again, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation, and also maybe speak of some of the success stories that maybe you've been able to bring about or facilitate others who get back on track, so to speak, or find, so to in this fashion, find their new purpose in life. So let's think about that. If you're out here, we'd love to have you in studio again.
I will be back in California in 2019 for sure. And I thank you so much from the heart for extending this great opportunity. I've loved being on your show, Richard.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for the work you're doing in the world.
Well, thank you very much. I also have three final questions for you before we let you go. The first is, who is Sherry Cormier?
Wow. That's a tough question. You mean, well, I'm a woman, I'm a writer, I'm a mother, I'm a daughter, I've been a wife. I really just like to think of myself as a warm-hearted, loving person.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
That's a great question, because I did not write this book really to become rich or famous. I think, you know, you have to be a CEO of a company to do that, probably. I'm really trying to provide comfort and hope and inspiration to people on their darkest days and darkest hours. That's probably my mission, and also to spread love and joy and peace throughout everyone's lives and throughout the world.
And I'll put this final question to you. What is your life's purpose?
Well, I think my life's purpose is to love, to give love, to just love. In whatever form that may be, however that may take me, to show love.
Sherry Cormier, PhD. She has a website, SherryCormierAuthor.com. You can find out more about Sweet Sorrow, Finding Enduring Wholeness After Loss and Grief. And I'm going to repeat this one more time, because I think it's certainly worth repeating. To live in this world, you must be able to do three things: to love what is mortal, to hold it against your bones, knowing your own life depends on it, and find the time, when the time comes, to let it go. That is from Mary Oliver. Again, Sherry Cormier, thank you so much. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to lull.